Well, hello, everyone. My name is Dr. Sherry Tenpenny, and I want to extend a warm welcome to all of you here at the Tenpenny Files Premium Membership for listening to these special interviews called the Deep Dive Podcast that are done specifically for you. So with that, let me introduce to you today's special deep dive guest, Lee Kessler. And if you missed the This Week with Dr. T, the first conversation we had, be sure that you go into the podcast area or go out to Cloud Hub and re-listen to it. It was an amazing conversation. And so you don't want to miss that. It was really, really good. Lee Kessler is a television actress, screenwriter, playwright, stage director, and e-commerce business owner. Her career in Hollywood and New York spans 40 plus years and includes dozens of guest starring roles in episodic TV, miniseries, and movies of the week. We talked in our previous interview about the Dazzling Daughters of the American Revolution, how she was inducted into that very exclusive group of just a small list of women, and you'll really want to go back and listen to that entire interview talking about that. Since the publication of her suspense novels, White King and the Doctor, White King Rising, and White King and the Battle for America, The Endgame, she has made numerous radio and TV appearances discussing these books, which we talked about a little bit in the first interview, was sort of a prelude of what's going to be coming here in another month or so. The relevance of the events that we all witnessed and experienced in the first two decades of the new millennium, and has spoken often at book signings and private readings in New York and Los Angeles. Lee, welcome back to the Deep Dive with Dr. T. Thank you for the generosity of your time to have spent another 45 minutes or so with us just for our Deep Dive members. Thank you so much.
You are welcome, and thank you. It's fun talking and getting to know you, and I know your people by you.
Oh, well, thank you. Well, I'd like to start our Deep Dive conversation so people get to know you a little bit better. Where were you born? And tell us a little bit about your childhood.
I grew up in a very small town, a village of about 900 people, and they counted the dogs in there for the census, too. I guess they got extra money from the state of New York. It was over in the western part of New York State, southeast of Buffalo and due south of Rochester, and just a tiny little village. And I'm grateful now, looking back over my life where I had to spend so much time in Los Angeles and New York, that I had that time in my life, where I was in a small village. People do care about each other, take care of one another. And my parents, my dad was an educator, but a brilliant one. Even though that was a small town, he was one of the top three educators in New York State back in the day when New York was number one in the nation. Yeah. And as I look back at him now, he's passed away for some years, that he was a man who knew what the final product of education is. And that is a citizen who can function. And so back when New York regents were the toughest regents, they didn't have separate ones for separate levels of IQ. Every one of his students, whether they were low IQ, high IQ, whatever, they all passed the regents. But he ran a tough ship, a tight ship, and he took a school that was failing, and was hired there, brought there as the principal, and he brought it up to one of the top three schools in the state. And that includes all those other major high schools and schools in the major cities. But he was a very principled man, and I learned a lot about character and integrity from him. And both sides of my family had been in the American Revolution, but also in New York State back then, they taught a lot, not just of American history, but they taught New York State history. Well, New York State history involves pre-revolution. It involves the French and Indian Wars. So I lived in and around Indian reservations. I have all my life, actually. But there, I just learned so much about where we came from. And being in a small town, though, I dreamed of a big life and a big future. And I went away to Grove City College, which you probably heard of, because Mark Levin talks about them quite a bit. And he has their economics professor and their poli-sci professor and so on there. Hillsdale and Grove City would be comparable colleges today. And that was, at that time, a Presbyterian college north of Grove City, north of Pittsburgh, in Grove City, Pennsylvania, liberal arts. And I was math and science. I was in pre-med because, when I was born, I have two brothers that have passed away now because they were in college when I was born.
Oh, wow.
So I got to spend almost time with them. I live like an only child, but they were farther ahead of me. And one of them was a world famous surgeon, and He taught anatomy at NYU for 40 years. They wouldn't let him go. He was 87 years old when they finally let him go.
Wow.
Because he was trained every doctor that came through their med school. He was top guy in the world in anatomy. And because of that, I was following in his footsteps. So when I went away to college, I thought I'm going to be a doctor. That seemed like the best application. But I had also been a musician. I'm a trombone player. And I had a good, strong background in that. And so I also had done plays in high school, and I got into theater in college, and that's where the path changed for me pretty dramatically.
Interesting. Yeah, I just want to take a step back. What do you think your dad would say today about the educational system, and not only maybe on a national level, but in New York? I mean, the destruction of, what do you think he would say about all of that?
First of all, I'm grateful he's not here to have witnessed it, because I remember that he suddenly retired earlier than we thought he would. And he had built a home across from the school, and it was a beautiful place. And as I say, it was doing very well. And he one day he just suddenly retired. And I remember I came home, I think it was in college, and I said, "Dad, you know, whatever you're doing, but why are you leaving?" And he said, "Because they are changing things here. And they were introducing psychologists mandatorily into every school. And I didn't understand the magnitude of what he was saying then, but 20 years later I did. But he said, they're going to mess it all up. They're going to destroy everything I have spent 40 years creating and building, not just at that school, but in others. And he said, and I can't stop that. And I didn't fully understand what he meant, but the changes were beginning, because that was the new age education. And, you know, they bring in all of these other values, and it came in through that Trojan horse. So he was sad and disappointed when he retired, because he knew what the outcome would be. He was just...
What year was that?
He retired in the 70s.
So that's when the whole revolution, evolution of where we are today kind of started in through the 70s then.
Yeah, yeah. Dewey, you know, the New York governors and New York education. And so, and the NEA started back in those days, if I remember. So I think he just knew what the natural outcome of that would be, because he was bringing people up to responsible adulthood, not to victimhood. I mean, he would be, as I said, I'm grateful that he didn't have to watch this today, but it's part of what inspires me to do what I do, is to honor him and what he did, because he saw it coming. He tried to warn me, he tried to warn them, but he knew it was unstoppable at that time.
Wow. So where was your, what was your journey to go from Grove College to Hollywood?
Well, first I, you know, completed at Grove City, and then I did my master's at University of Wisconsin in Madison. During what they call the war at home, the movie documentary was filmed there, because Madison, Wisconsin that year was the most violent campus in America, even beyond Berkeley. So wow. I'd gone from this insulated, lovely, charming, you know, Christian college, if you will, to this amazing place. We were under martial law the whole year I was there. And I took my master's in acting and directing there. And honestly, the reason that I had, it's weather. We went through the winter weather there, and the riots and all the protesting and the burning and all that, and the National Guard went away during the winter, because Wisconsin winter is very, very tough in Madison, so nobody wanted to be out. And during that time, it got to like minus 70 below in the winter.
Wow.
So I have to walk to class to get to my classes and my rehearsals and so on. And I remember thinking, I could go into the theater in New York, or I could go to Hollywood. And I saw the movie, the Mrs. Robinson one, with Dustin Hoffman. I've forgotten the name of it. And that famous song that, you know, Mrs. Robinson, where the young guy has the affair. But they had this beautiful shot of the Pacific Coast Highway as he's driving up towards where his home is. And I looked at that and I said, that is amazing. So strictly, Sherry, on the basis of weather, I decided to go into television and film instead of only theater, which, because there wasn't much TV at all done at that time in New York. And so headed out to Hollywood, and I caught an early break out there. I was married to my debate partner. We were successful debate champions, and he wanted to go to USC Law School. So it was, the deal was I would put him through law school, and then once he was done with that and passed the bar and got started, then I would start into the entertainment industry. And so we got established out there, started going. But once I did start, I caught a very early break playing Margaret Truman in a movie about the Truman-MacArthur conflict called Collision Course. And E.G. Marshall and Henry Fonda were the stars. And there were only two women's parts in it, and mine was the biggest. But it stood out because of the subject matter. And I was playing Margaret Truman, and most people knew her story. So people in Hollywood just thought I was a New York actress that had been brought in to do this. And it was such a high profile project that I immediately then started getting work in some of the most high profile television things going on, like Roots and all kinds of miniseries. My early career was a lot of miniseries, that, and Roots was the first one ever done. And I was in that and got to know Alex Haley. So I started in movies of the week and miniseries, and then navigated on over to guest starring roles in series. I didn't so much want to be part of a series where I'd be playing the same character all the time. I'm what's known as a character lead. I mean, I can carry all the leading role, but a character lead is someone who has, you know, they can be different characters. They're not going on their own personality only. They can change into other characters. And I liked the challenge of that. So every guest starring role I had on major series, it was a new character in a new situation. And I liked that and was doing that. And then it transitioned into the recurring roles, like on Matlock and Hill Street Blues. And then we got into what we were talking about earlier, that Hollywood is changing and I didn't like it anymore. But I went because of weather and I stayed because of weather.
Do you have a, looking back over your career, do you have a favorite role, one that you like the best?
Yes, actually. And it was the sitcom Barney Miller. And that became, this particular episode, I did more than one, but this one became one of their classics. And I was playing a gal, depressed, tries to jump off the Brooklyn Bridge, and they catch her before she does. And they bring her into the precinct. But just prior to that, they brought into the precinct a guy who writes obscenities on bathroom walls. And they put him in the jail cell. And while they're trying to do paperwork on me and get me transported over to Bellevue, he and I start in a conversation and this relationship starts up. So they haul him away and they put me in the cell. And what became the classic part is that he wrote me a message before he left. Now, this is the guy who writes obscenities on bathroom walls. He wrote me a message before he left. And then I'm in this cell and you can tell that I've got the message and the rest is me trying to figure out how to get reconnected with this guy. So it's very funny. But it was one of the most difficult, challenging roles that I ever had to play, because the drama, it had to be real and plausible that this was a suicidal young woman and very, very lonely. And yet it's a comedy. And so I had to make that, you know, walk that fine line that you're laughing at the same time you're getting the humanity of two lonely people who finally do get together, because what he left her was his phone number.
Oh.
So she's memorizing his phone number as she's walking out. But that cast, that crew, I enjoyed them, the fun of it. I mean, a lot of my experiences have been wonderful. And then I became the first woman, actually probably only the second woman in the world, but the first woman in the world to portray the legendary diarist Anna Eastman. And I had written a play based upon her diaries and took that, and I played Anna East and took that show into New York under my own production banner. And that was an amazing experience altogether, just to get the rights to do it. And if you look at me today, people would say, I cannot imagine that you would have played on Eastman. And I said, yeah, well, as I said, I'm a character actor.
I don't know who that is. Explain that person and what that is to the audience.
She's
here.
Extremely prolific writer, but her diaries, well, all of her life, she was a diarist. So she wrote erotic literature. I mean, personality wise, we would be opposites completely. But she wrote erotic literature, but the diaries were really a woman's journey. And she got into a lot of stuff pre-World War II, living on a houseboat in Paris, romance with the playwright Henry Miller and his wife June. And it's a period of time. That's where my play takes place, is in pre-World War II on the houseboat in Paris. But what I did admire about her, she was her own woman. Feminists tried to embrace her, and she would never go for it. And I remember having an interview with the NOW, National Organization of Women. They want to interview me because the play was out at that time. And I said, well, you do understand that she was not a feminist. She was an independent woman, obviously a controversial in some ways, certainly a free spirit, and had her own moral codes and so on. She was not a feminist. And they said she wasn't. And I said, oh, no. She was not a feminist at all. She just listened, you know, she marched to her own music with that. I said, she did not believe, and it's written in her diary, she did not believe that you could should rise as a woman by climbing on the backs of men or belittling or berating men. She loved men. She just was her own woman, but very independent. So she rose in fame and literature for her diaries, which were edited to protect her husband and some other people. After she passed away, the unedited diaries they allowed, after not only she, but when both husbands had passed away, they were allowed to release the unedited diaries. But the edited diaries are poetic. They are a deep dive into the psyche of a woman struggling at that era in that world picture and trying to stay out of the political scene. But she wasn't. She wrote beautifully, and her diaries are quite beautiful. But for me to approach that and to take it and to get the rights for it was unbelievable, the project, because I first wrote the play, and she had passed away, and I met with her husband, and he said, he asked for the meeting. He said, I've read the play. He said, it's quite amazing what you've done, what you've edited, what you've put together. And we met, and I thought he was going to give me the rights. And he said, now I need to see how you're going to portray her. And I said, excuse me? I said, that would mean a full production on spec, you know, writer, director, theater. I'd have to do a whole production for you to see how I'm going to portray this, because it's an extremely difficult part, one woman play. And so I'm on stage the entire time covering about 8 years of her life. And I wrote things that nobody's ever attempted to do ever in a one person show. And he said, well, if you want the rights, I need to see it. I said, okay. I was too deep into it by that point, you know. So I said, I'll go ahead and do it. I got a theater that I was part of a repertory company with, got my director and set designer and so on. And he came along with some of her best friends. And I had a few people in the audience, and I performed it. At the break, when I came back at the intermission, all of her friends had left, but he was still there. And, you know, you can't stop it. I didn't know, you know, I noticed it. But I just had to go. But I thought, oh dear, that's probably not a good sign. But I had done what I did. And then he called the next day and said, come on over to the house. And he said, first of all, I need to explain to you. And my friend and her friends wanted me to give you the apology. They left only because they were overcome with emotion. That somehow you had transformed into her. Remember what we were talking about in that earlier segment? You have to be able to switch the viewpoint and be plausibly the person you're playing, whether they're like you or not. He said they were so overcome that they thought they were with her.
Oh, wow.
So they just left, but they wanted me to convey their apologies. And he said, now, for me, he said, that was amazing, and you have my absolute approval to take this anywhere you want to take it. So I did. So that was a number of years of my life, and that was a fun, fun role. Very, very demanding.
How long did that run?
Well, it ran in New York only for a short time, because once you open, the New York Times review timed late. It was not a negative review. It just timed late. And when it times late, the audience doesn't come in enough. So we had some other positive reviews. We had a couple of negative. And so we failed in New York. But I had it out on tour probably, you know, maybe a year all told. But I had the project for 7 years and then said, no, I'm done with that now. And people had asked me to, could I get it available for them to put it out so other people could play it? And I said, no, I can't. You understand, I'm the only person in the world authorized to portray her. Actors Equity, the Actors Guild, had to give special approval for the production, because they said, okay, you're the star of the show, and who's your understudy? And I said, there's no understudy. They said, no, mandatorily, there's an understudy, because we had all the contracts and all the stuff you had to do for the union. I said, no, there can't be an understudy. The contract drawn on this estate, from this estate, is that I'm the only one who could play her. And so that had to go for board approval from Actors Equity for me to be alone there, the only one who could portray her, and with no understudy. And so it was just a fascinating time, and I learned so much in that process. And that was the last thing I ever wanted to do on the stage, actually. Prior to that, I'd been a big part of the LA theater scene. But that role was so demanding, I said, to be honest with myself, I've done everything that I'd ever be challenged to do just in that one role. So I then just spent the rest of the time in TV and film, and then transitioned into writing.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah.
Did you ever, you know, I live in Cleveland, Ohio. Did you ever do anything here in Cleveland? Cleveland's got a big theater district downtown.
It's the Cleveland Playhouse there. I never did, but I knew the actors from the Cleveland Playhouse because they would come over to Chautauqua, New York. You know where Chautauqua is?
Yeah, for sure.
Very close to where I live. In fact, kind of around the corner. If you come around the corner from Cleveland on up into the western part of New York State and heads towards Chicago, I'm from Andover, New York. And so I would, and I hadn't gone into acting yet, but I wanted to. I was still in college, but I would hang out with the actors who came over with the Cleveland Rep to perform there in the summer. So I knew I could do it. You have to have a break. And I got a very, very good agent. And that was a wonderful story too. But because of her reputation, I got auditions for things that I otherwise wouldn't have. So when I look back on that time, it was a very positive time and a lot of fun. I met wonderful actors. My projects were quality projects. So I wasn't hanging out with jerk directors and people like that. I mean, everybody really knew that there was a lot going and a lot writing and possibilities of nominations and awards and so on, but everybody had a mission. And so I was very happy for the first 8 years until we got into the blacklisting stuff and the content stuff.
Well, you've done just some amazing things. When you look back on your life, or you know that, you know, some one of these days, I mean, on demand is pointed once to die. None of us are getting out of here alive.
Yeah.
How would you like to be remembered?
Most definitely, I would like to be remembered as a patriot who, whatever my values and principles were, that everything I did in my life, in business, in the arts, in whatever, that it would bring about a world that doesn't have war, doesn't have insanity and criminality, that the world got better, and that I was relentlessly persistent to the end.
Wow. That's amazing. So I'm going to switch gears a little bit and ask you a couple lighter questions since we've been doing some fun things. When you're not writing or you're not doing involved with all the different things, what do you like to do for fun?
Well, I live in Montana now. And see, that had been a lifelong dream. From the time I was 3 years old in New York State, I would walk up to people and announce, I'm going to live on a ranch in Montana. And I'd never been there. My family had never been there. And my parents didn't even know where I got that idea. But I was always announcing it all through my life. But I never went there. And then after 9/11, my late husband, who was a professional rodeo rider and just a consummate businessman as well, said, Lee, you've never even been to Montana. You've always said you want to go there. Instead of going out of country, why don't we take a driving trip? So we took our yellow lab to give her a road trip. And we drove up through Wyoming and came down into Montana. And within 15 minutes, every 15 minutes, I was saying, I love Montana. He knew by the time that trip was over, we'd be leaving Hollywood. 4 months later, excuse me, I'd gone into semi-retirement, sold our property, bought a ranch nearby where I live now, and moved up here. So I love being outdoors. I love walking. I'm not a big hiker, but I'll do gentle hikes. You know, at my age, I'm not going to do the extreme stuff. I love hiking. I love being with the people. I love being out with animals. I enjoy business. I get a lot of fun because in my business, I'm trying to raise up the next generation of leaders and entrepreneurs in the United States. So I get to have the fun of coaching young men and women, you know, 20, 22, 23, 24, 25. And that's fun for me because I don't have children of my own. It's very fun for me to be with them and establish not just a professional relationship, but a personal relationship. But mostly I love travel to scenery and other places. And I love this country. I think every state has its beauty in the United States. Every one of them has something so unique. And I encourage people to do more traveling with that. And I love to read. And I love movies because that was my field. And I'm a great audience person because I don't go judgmentally at all. When friends would ask me to come to the theater and see them in a play or see them in New York or come and see them in a film, and then they would want me to tell them what I thought about the performance. And I say, I was just sitting there as the audience. I was just enjoying it as an audience member. I'm not your critique. You want to hire an acting coach or something. You know, I didn't come here to critique you, let alone put you down. But I loved it. And so I love going to movies even to this day. I don't like to watch them at home. I like to go with the big screen where it was really meant, how it's filmed.
You've mentioned that you read a lot. Do you have a favorite author?
I've had several through time. When I was younger, leading up to my career, it was Ayn Rand, and I'm often compared to her.
Wow.
I'm often compared to Ayn Rand, and not because of style, and it certainly wouldn't even be content. I think it's just the will that she had a philosophical approach to her novels, and I have a philosophical approach to mine. I love Mark Twain, but I love Charles Dickens when I was coming up. All of his novels, particularly A Tale of Two Cities. I liked and learned from the other ones and the characters and the oddities because our family's British. But A Tale of Two Cities, you really look at, it was the best of times, it was the worst of times. And that story just fascinated me. And I think we're in A Tale of Two Cities right now. It's the best of times and it's the worst of times. The best of human nature can come up and rise up, and the worst of nature is coming up. So I liked him, and Thomas Hardy, even though today I wouldn't embrace that philosophy at all, you know, because he always had those wonderful stories of the near misses, you know, where the people went this way, and when they should have just come together, there was just the two ships passing in the night, but great romances, great characters. And I loved Thomas Hardy. And then years later, when I look back, I said, you're nothing like Thomas Hardy anymore. You get frustrated when people don't open their mouth, because they would have come together had either one of them just spoken. But you know how we can all get in our heads and say, well, they don't dare speak because they might think this, and I don't know how
for sure.
And people, because he was always, they were all of his characters were always into their heads on stuff, and they would miss each other. So it was like fatalist drama. He felt it was like fate. Well, I don't believe in that, you know, at this point. I believe that we're the architect. We're responsible for the condition we're in. So now I look back on that and I say, who would that be? But I write suspense novels, and people have said, do you have a favorite suspense author? And I would say probably Nelson DeMille, but I purposely don't read Clancy because I'm also compared to Clancy, Tom Clancy, a lot. And I don't read those guys anymore because I don't want any of their style to accidentally get embraced here. I have my own signature now. Mm-hmm. I'm my own writer, and there's a style in which I create characters and what I focus on. But a nonfiction. I read a lot of self-help books. That's about it.
That's it. That's good. You mentioned a couple of times, and I mentioned it in your bio, that you have an e-commerce business. What
yes. I went into network marketing very successfully years ago, 40 years ago, because that mentor had said to me, listen, Lee, if you're going to stand on principle, you need to be financially independent. But we'd also had two strikes in the entertainment industry, a writer's strike followed by an actor's strike. They were back to back. They lasted 6.5 months. And so even though I was working, I was on the series Hill Street Blues at the time, you know, a long time like that, my savings and my financial reserves went down. I got out of it without losing my home, but many of my friends had lost theirs. And I also was starting to run into some of that unpredictable, vindictive aspect of Hollywood and some threats if I try to protect another actor or whatever. So I said, you know what? I need another source of income. And network marketing for me was the ideal thing because it was part-time. I could control the hours of it. It had very good income potential. I was working with a very, very established company. But that's where I met the mentors that had the greatest impact on my life, including the mentor whose statements to me ultimately led to everything I've done in the White King series.
Wow.
Yeah. It was, he taught me about the simmering frog. how to simmer, how to cook a frog, and then also a filmmaker, Yvonne Passer, because I think my favorite experience was probably with Peter O'Toole in the movie Creator. But that's where I got to have meet and became close friends with until he passed away, the filmmaker, Yvonne Passer. And he, one day we were, Peter O'Toole, my scenes were all with Peter O'Toole. And he would sometimes not be able to come out of his trailer because he had the drug issues. And he was very, very temperamental. If he liked you as an actor and respected you, he played with you wonderfully. And he did. He respected me and played with me wonderfully. If he didn't, he was temperamental. But when he was on drugs, you never knew it was him. So I got to hang out with the director and just be on the set. And one day we were driving back on the bus, the shuttle, taking us back to our hotel from the scene, from the set. And it was just the director. He's at the back. I'm up front. And all of a sudden, he had escaped from Czechoslovakia with Milos Forman. I'm in their pajamas in the dead of night because they were dissidents and they were making a movie that was anti-communist. And somebody had blown the whistle on them. They escaped. So I knew his background from coming out from behind the Iron Curtain. Out of the blue at the back of the bus, he said, "Hey, Lee, do you know how to cook a toad?" And I said, "As a matter of fact, I do. I have a business mentor who taught me that. Why are you asking?" And he said, "Because America's being cooked." Mm. This was 1986.
Oh, my goodness.
And I said, yes. So that began kind of a rapport along those lines, because I became someone safe in Hollywood for him to talk to, because he could not express those ideas safely in Hollywood, which is more communist leaning, you know. And so that led to that great friendship. And
you know, that's a really great analogy. And, you know, it's talking about what your dad had said, and, you know, left in the 70s. And the National Education Association got started about that time. And in the 1960s, I mean, when the healthcare started to go south was with the implementation of Medicare and Medicaid. You know, CMS was what changed everything. You know, they, just for the sake of the listeners, you know, they implemented Medicare in 1963, saying that when you were 65, you could go on Medicare, because at that point in time, life expectancy was 70 for men and about 72 for women. And so they thought, well, we could take care of these old people for a couple of years. They right. never anticipated, you know, fast forward 70 years later, that life expectancy is now in the 80s and yeah. people retire at 65. And so we've got to support end of life medical care, which is the most expensive ever. It's where we spend most of our dollars in healthcare. And there isn't the number of revenue generators underneath that, but it was the implementation of Medicare, Medicaid that really was the beginning of the end of healthcare as we, let me rephrase that. It was the beginning of what we got now, which is just right. a big mess. So, yeah. you know, that cooking, saying that America's like the cook the frog scenario. And yeah. just for the sake of the listeners, tell them that story, just in case somebody yeah. doesn't know what that means.
This is literally, if you attempt to cook a frog and you drop him in boiling water, he's going to hop right out. He's capable of doing that because he perceives mortal danger and boop, he's out. So you put him in cool water, set the pan on the stove, and just turn the heat up, and it's warming up slowly. So he's warming up, warming up, warming up. By the time the instinct tells him this is mortal, he can't move. He can't get out. And that's exactly what I feel has been happening. My business mentor had put attention on that because we worked together in network marketing, but he was a visionary on global business and all kinds of things, very bright guy. So he was the first one that turned me on to that concept. But how we would look at that and find that globally in politics, in religion, in education, and so on, because we were trying to reverse that by bringing an educational system into our business model that would help young men and women become leaders and independent thinkers and independent people. And so that simmering frog stuck with me on that. And he was also the first one to begin to discuss the New World Order, which has now evolved into the Great Reset. The changing, one of the techniques of perception management, which we did discuss, is redefinition of terms. If you change the definitions of things, you alter people's perceptions on concepts and things. And so globalism sounds like a good word. It really is the New World Order. But then they changed it to globalism. And everybody kind of likes that idea. Oh, that sounds good. That we would globally connect and we have the tools for it and everything. But that really now has transformed into the Great Reset, which is openly spoken about. And had I not had those conversations with these people, these were concepts that shocked me when they said them. And like good men, all it takes for evil to triumph is for good men to do nothing. So not only with my dad, but with the men that I chose to be with professionally, both in the entertainment industry and in business, these were men who challenged me. I didn't necessarily agree with all this when they said it. It was a bit of a slap in the face or a startling thing to me, but I was willing to look. And as I looked, I found. So I'm grateful that I met these people. You know how the choices we make in life, I think we make them good. Even if a choice led into some danger, we can turn it around and make it into good. But I'm very, when I look back, I've had such wonderful people in my life that I admired and respected. And they didn't try to turn me into them. They simply challenged me to think on my own.
Boy, and that's really what we need today, isn't it? And I'm so glad to hear you talk about what you're doing with these young people, because they have, I'm going to keep using that because I know that story, that they have been the cooked frog, you know, that started when they were in kindergarten and first grade. And we tried to teach them a different form of math that didn't work. And now we've got kids that are, you know, graduating from high school that can't even read to a sixth grade level and can't even do basic math without doing it with their calculator. And so they really have been the cook, the frog, that whole generation.
Yeah. And the enemy, the opponent who's doing that knows exactly what they're doing, because it worked in communist China. It worked in the Soviet Union. Because if you can't think and you can't reason and you just can't really function in life, you will be willingly under the control of others. They can step in and say, don't worry about it. We'll fix that for you. So even the medical things you were talking about, I understand where it comes from, because it always comes initially from good intentions.
Exactly.
See, that's how they hurt everybody. That exactly. There's a problem. Somebody looks at it and looks at a solution. Now the solution looks good. So the intentions are pure. And I'm trying to be very, very careful, if not careful, conscientious about the fact when I'm dealing with people or working with, not to disrespect them, that there's a difference between who they are and their intentions and what the outcome of their actions can be. Because the outcome has been deadly for us.
Yeah, you know, a lot of government programs start out sounding really good. We need to take care of those poor people. We need to give them a universal basic income so everybody's always got a little bit of money. We need to make these little things like chipped into your hand because of convenience and you don't have to worry about taking your credit card anymore.
These
things just start so good and end up so nefarious.
Right. That which you just described is the plot of the fourth and final novel.
Yeah.
It's from every section.
And unless people understand the nefarious side of this, you know, that it's the Hegelian principle, right? The problem, reaction, solution. And in the problems have been identified, they're going to ramp up and get even worse. And so then the solution is going to be your universal basic income, your 15-minute cities, your you can't buy, sell, or trade unless you've got this little chip.
Oh, yeah.
All of those things.
Oh, yeah. And at that point, we're done as a free people, not just Americans, but everybody, because they're not just going to do it to us. Yeah.
Right.
You know, I was lucky with my dad, because I remember when I was a little girl, because with my brothers gone and I lived like an only child, but my folks were middle aged, I was around mature people. So I got to listen as a little kid to a lot of mature conversations. But my dad would explain things. And then I remember one day he said, Lee, just remember that anytime you do something for someone that they could or should do for themselves, you demean and degrade them. And I was a little kid looking at that, and I said, but I got it. Now, there are some people that must have help because they can't do something for themselves. But when somebody could do it and should do it, it actually it does degrade them, and it assumes on our side a superiority. And that has grown now into this global, where you have these global elites who think nothing of us. They think that none of us is capable. And so they degrade and demean with income, the assumption that the inner city children in the schools, they've got IQ, they've got capability, but if they can't get into a good education system, they're not going to have a good life. That's why I personally appreciated vouchers and was always interested in having parents be able to have vouchers and get their kids out of that, because I understand, I understand American history, and I understand plantations too. and the Civil War. My family fought in the Civil War. Those inner city school systems in the inner city and where everybody's being driven now, those are modern day plantations, and they can't escape. Everything has to be given to them. And whether in the medical world, whether it's Medicare, Medicaid, but notice that people want everything. And this whole thing about doing away with advanced placement or advanced studies, that if you are exceptional or you've risen and worked harder and done something special, they're going to cancel that program. And so it's the degrading of people down to mediocrity and below, because that's how you would create a slave state. You can't have a slave state if you got a bunch of free thinking, smart, independent people that are entrepreneurial and free enterprise, which is our economic system. They took that out of the school system a long time ago. So most Americans don't even understand the economic system. The young people will embrace socialism because they like things being given to them, because they've had things being given to them their whole life. So I think we got plenty of work to do.
Yes, we do.
Fortunately, I believe that if you're going to do a game, even if it's a deadly game, you should do it with a spirit of play. And it's kind of like I would pay attention to Patton, General Patton, as I love war movies and stuff, because he was a brilliant general. He was a tough general, but he also just had a sense of humor about him, you know, that with that sense of humor behind him, he could throw himself and his armies into battles, and it would just throw the opposition completely off. And when you look through history, there's been a lot of them like that, that they're just happy warriors. And so when you say, what do I have fun doing? I actually have fun being in a fight. I don't mean a physical fight. I have fun being in this fight because I am a happy warrior. And I don't go about to degrade people, and I don't assume that the people that I meet are incompetent and cannot take care of themselves. Quite the opposite. I'm trying to inspire them to know, listen, you've got greatness in you, period. That's and let beautiful. It out, for Pete's sake. Stop listening to all these people. Know your own goodness, know your own power, know your own intellect. You just have to know that you know things. You weren't created by a slug, you know.
That's very good. Well, Lee, I want to thank you so much for your candid disclosure and the generosity of your time. What a great conversation we've had here on the Deep Dive with Dr. T. Where can they find your books and your writings, and how can we best support you from that?
It definitely helps with the books, because since those books are prescient and they're it's writing about real life world right now, but through the point of view of the enemy and offering hope and solutions, they can get anything at amazon.com. Just look up my name. But my own website, which has videos and the launch video and information and interviews and reviews and so on, is whitekingrising.com. And my blog site is leekessler.net. But if people forget that, just Google search Lee Kessler and you'll find them.
They'll find you. That's great. That's awesome.
Or I'll reach you and I'll give you all that.
Yeah.
You can have it.
Well, we'll put it down in the show notes down below, so people have access to those. So as we close out today, I want to once again say thank you to our premium podcast members. These deep dives are designed for you, and nobody else gets to see them. They're not out on the general public, and this is specifically as a thank you. And as you can see, we have great conversations of wisdom and humor and inspiration with our guests that we have here at the Deep Dive. And I want to thank Lee Kessler again for being such an inspiration to the world and all the things you're doing. And I can't wait until we can do this four-part series with your book. So with that, I want to just close out. You know, you guys have been following me for a long time, know that I always close out all of my broadcasts, whether they're pre-recorded or whether they're live, with one of my favorite verses from the Bible, which is Romans 12:12. Rejoice in hope, be patient in trouble, and be persistent in prayer. So until we meet again on the next broadcast, stay strong, stay in prayer, lean into God. He'll never let you down. And one last thing, stick around before you go for another couple of minutes, and you'll hear about some special offers just for our premium content members with these new commercials that we just made. We spent a lot of time on them. Even if you don't buy anything from them, stick around and watch them, because they're really pretty darn good. And it would just be an honor for us to be able to, for you to look at all the work that we did to put into them. So thank you so much. And thank you again, Lee. And until we meet again, everybody, have a wonderful rest of your week. Take care.
In a time when truth is censored, one name stands out. Dr. Sherry Tenpenny, the relentless seeker of knowledge and defender of freedom. Explore groundbreaking findings at drtenpenny.com Ignite your mind with riveting podcasts, explosive articles, research-driven substacks, webinars, ebooks, and more. In an era plagued by environmental toxins and vaccine-related exposures, Dr. Tenpenny has expertly crafted a selection of safe detox protocols that facilitate profound healing at a cellular level. It's time to cleanse, rejuvenate, and restore your body's vitality. With heart damage on the rise, Dr. Tenpenny introduces nationwide ECP therapy to repair hearts and achieve optimal health. Seize the opportunity and embrace the wealth of resources, information, and health recommendations awaiting you at drtenpenny.com and become a Tenpenny podcast member to join our mission in the quest for uncensored truth, the health of our nation, and medical freedom.